Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 47, text number 30 through 37. We'll chant text number 30 responsibly. Atmani evatmunatmanam srije panme anupalaye atma mayanubhavena utindriya gunatmana atmanyevatmanatmanam srijehanmyanupalaye atma mayanubhavena bhutendriya gunatmana atmanamevanatmanam srijehanmyanupalaye atma mayanubhavena bhutendriya gunatmana. Please chant. Anybody? Nevatmanatmanam Srijeham Yanupalaye Atma Mayanupavena Bhutendriya Gunatmana Atman Yevatmanatmanam Srijeham Yanupalaye Atma Mayanupavena Bhutendriya Gunatmana. Atmanevatmanatmanam Atmani, within myself, eva, indeed, atmana, by myself, atmanam, myself, srije, I create, on me, I destroy, anupalaye, I sustain, atma, my own, maya, of the mystic potency, anubhavena, by the power, bhuta, the material elements, indriya, the senses, guna, and the modes of nature, atmana, comprising. Translation. By myself I create, sustain, and withdraw myself within myself by the power of my personal energy, which comprises the material elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. Please repeat. By myself I create, sustain, and withdraw myself within myself, by the power of my personal energy, which comprises the material elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Although the Lord is the supreme entity, there is no absolute duality between him and his creation, since the creation is an extension of his being. This oneness is here emphasized by the Lord. Om adhyana timiram dasya janan jana shalakaya chaksu unmanitam yunatasmai sri gurave namaha mukam karoti vachalam pangumlam jayate agirim yakripa tamaham bande sri gurum dinatarinam vancha kalpaturibhyas cha kripa sindhu bahiva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha jaya sri krishna chaitanya prabhu nitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I have seven verses today. So we're just doing the first one responsibly, and I'm going to work through each one of them throughout this presentation. Srimad Bhagavatam itself is the supreme literature. And it's meant particularly for us in this day and age. When Vyasadeva was putting together the Vedas, the dryness of the entirety of the Vedas was noted, and Srimad Bhagavatam was the result of the rectification of that. Therefore, it's called the cream of the cream, sweetest, if you will. So, it's presented for us in a manner that is suitable for this day and age, as we are unfortunate, uninclined to philosophy, short-lived, etc., generally, in a miserable condition. Being in the material world in and of itself is a miserable condition, first of all. Being in the material world in the age of Kali Yuga is even more miserable. And being in the material world in the age of Kali Yuga here in the West even just tops it off with the cherry. So, it's not a very nice package. So Bhagavatam is presented for us. To me, it's nonetheless amazing that we're being given a subject such as this, which is so extremely intimate, so detailed and personal. Yet, at the same time, if we review this and as we're doing, and as Prabhupada encouraged us to do, we see that it's a very important and very deep conversation between Uddhava and the gopis. It has its multi-level dimensions, if you will, of impact, both from the storytelling point of view of the succession of Krishna's activities, from the philosophical point of view of the instructions being given to the general living entity, and then from the very personal point of view, as a message of the heart from Krishna to his gopis, and then from the instructive point of view, as that message is given through the medium of Uddhava for Uddhava's purification and realization. Just another example of Krishna's description by the name Chatur Atma, one who can accomplish many things at one activity. So by this activity, the Lord has accomplished so many different things. So this conversation in and of itself, despite the apparent loftiness of it, it could actually be the sole conversation of our hearing and chanting. It has such an importance in the culture of Srimad Bhagavatam, both in its deeper meaning, as I've mentioned, and then its practical application in our daily lives as devotees, as we're progressing and endeavoring to advance and endeavor to progress forward in our development of devotional service. This is one of the reasons why Srila Prabhupada was so keen to put together Krishna book, Story of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, before the 10th canto, because due to his age, due to his realization of time, as you might say, He had an understanding. I may not get this completed in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam, but this is so essential. Therefore, he presented it to us. Now, personally for myself, I have to say, despite all of this loftiness, I'm actually very, very familiar with this particular chapter. This is due to my association of my good friend and brahmacharya associate from St. Louis, Prana. Prana had some really amazing foresight and progressive vision, if you will, back in, this would have been like 74, maybe 75, way before anybody thought of recording books on tape and way before anybody was doing soundtracks and all of these readings that we now have so many devotees have done. Prana started this out. He would read, there were two particular chapters that touched him at the time that he did this recordings for. One was this chapter, the message of Uddhava to the gopis, and the other one was the appearance of Lord Vraha. And if you happen to be fortunate to have any collections of the old cassettes, because he never digitalized anything, that was all much, much later. These were very, very incredible recordings for the time period. The quality and the choice of background music to enhance the different moods. And we used to listen to these for hours on end, day after day, week after week, year after year. And when we were traveling out on traveling Sankirtan, we always had these there and just listen to this particular story. And then even years later, when I was introduced to Govardhana Shalagram Puja, this used to be what I listened to during my puja in the morning. So this chapter, I'm very familiar with the subject matter, having heard it for many years like that. And of course, eternally grateful to Prana for that service he rendered, which many devotees are very appreciative of. So it became a very deep-rooted, this particular section of the Bhagavatam became a very deep-rooted section for the devotional foundation of my own and for many of us our foundation of our hearing and chanting in Krishna consciousness, because this is an important instruction that's being given, an important conversation that's being presented to us. Nonetheless, to sit in front of the assembled Vaishnavas and speak from this chapter on so-called thoughts and realizations about this is a bit intimidating. I can think of a variety of people that are much more knowledgeable of the different depths of this pastime that are suitable to speak and already have. So torch has been passed to me, so do the best we can. We have our service to Srila Prabhupada. We often hear that the name of Radha is not mentioned in the Bhagavatam. This is a common subject that's noted. And if we go back a few verses here, we're on text 30. The majority of the previous texts in this chapter have been spoken by Radharani to this point. She's, engaging in this conversation. At least at the beginning here, as she's about to hear the message of Uddhava, it's like, why should I bother? And she continues down there. We don't see the phrase, as is commonly at the beginning of verse, Sukadeva Uvacha, Yudhishthira Uvacha, Maitreya Uvacha. We don't see Radha Uvacha. It's not there. You know, it's just, instead, we see Gopi Uvacha, or as is used in the text 11 when she begins her statements, Kaschit, meaning a particular gopi. So, you know, this is what we find to be true, that even though she's the speaker, she's not noted by name. Yet, the acharyas, both past and present, make no qualms in their purports of identifying clearly that this is Srimati Radharani speaking, and that she is in the process of speaking this, giving us an example of that deep love that she has for Sri Krishna. The ability to see a common humblebee, Madhukaram, just a common bumblebee flying around and then mistake that to be Krishna, and then engage in an entire conversation from that is very symptomatic of an altered state of consciousness. Now, those of us that have had the fortune of living in New York City for some time have seen these persons of altered state of consciousness on the streets of New York carrying on conversations quite vividly with nobody, or at least nobody that we see. I remember, you know, when I did live in New York, you'd see somebody walking on the street talking to themselves. You're like, all right. Of course, nowadays, everybody walks around talking to themselves. They've got something plugged into their ear, and you have no idea if there's something plugged into their ear. They don't even have a phone anymore. It's just a little thing stuck in their ear, and they're walking around talking to themselves and considered perfectly normal. So, you know, times do change. But in this classic example here, what would appear externally and mundanely to be a symptom of madness, of insanity, is understood to be the highest level of a manifestation of love for God. Radharani's engaged in a conversation, and the bumblebee's not even, it's not even like the bumblebee's a personality and talking back to her. Just in her ecstatic state of love, she's perceiving this bumblebee to be the representative of Krishna, connecting it to Krishna. In other words, everything she's perceiving is connected back to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, if we look at this particular verse here, this first one here, it's extremely philosophical. It doesn't appear to have any particular connection with a lila. You know, by myself, within myself, by the power of myself, I created this entire universe. And he goes on in this way, the senses, the elements, material nature. It appears that we're talking two different storylines here. The perception of Radharani that this bumblebee is a messenger of Krishna is the duality that we perceive to attain in devotional service. While on one hand being conscious of the philosophical content and foundation of the devotional process, of the Vedic literatures, at the same time maintaining that, but having a higher level of consciousness fixed in true love of God. Are we likely to attain that? Have any of us attained it? Well, that's open for discussion, and I'll leave that to others. But the fact of the matter is that is our goal. That's the direction. That's what the purpose of the Bhagavatam is, to take us down that road. It's interesting because the philosophical basis is open to everyone. It's something that we discuss, it's something that we preach, it's something we openly talk about to anyone, but yet the intimate side of that same coin is kept a little bit secretive. To the degree that when Uddhava begins to deliver the... Now, Uddhava's come to Nandagram. He's addressing Nanda Maharaj and the older cowherd men and all the... You know, and everybody's there at Nandagram and they're having this great conversation. And then he's going to speak to the gopis. He removes them from that scenario. Okay, this is something a little more confidential. The place is actually called Uddhavakari. And it's between Varshana and Nandagram, which if you kind of get a little analytical, it's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, Varshana is Radharani's place, Nandagram is Krishna's place, and Uddhava goes to the middle spot between the two to speak with them, which if you look geographically, is triangular to Govardhan. And Govardhan, of course, is where in his later time, Uddhava resides there in this transcendental form as these creepers, just to be stepped on by the gopis. So, kind of an interesting philosophical, geographical, you know, subtle arrangement there. So at any rate, Uddhava sets him aside because this conversation he's going to speak to about then isn't for the ears of Nanda, isn't for the ears of Jasoda, it's just for the ears of the gopis, headed by Srimati Radharani. And the level of appreciation that they have exhibited, that Krishna has appreciated, and that Krishna will now reciprocate with. Now, in that reciprocation, Krishna, as I say, starts out with these very philosophical content. This first verse here breaks down the understanding of how the Lord creates everything, maintains it, and I noted here, interestingly enough, the word hunmi means destroy. I destroy. Hun and then me, I destroy. But in the translation, the word withdraw is used. a little more soft. I'm going to withdraw your existence. So at any rate, the three aspects of Lord Vishnu, his creative, sustaining, and destructive aspect are noted. And he emphasizes how this happens as an expansion from me, and it's complete within itself. And this process is what comprises the material elements, the senses, the three modes of material nature. All of this working together, it's all coming from me. Now, let's just detach ourselves for a moment here and look at this. You've got the gopis, completely in horrible feelings of separation from the Lord, and they've heard that now Uddhava has come with a message from the Lord for them. You can imagine the anticipation and joy that develops within their heart. So Uddhava withdraws them quietly. The anticipation is beginning. Oh, it's even more confidentially stated. And then he begins preaching to them about the basics of the creation, material senses and the material nature and creation and destruction. And I can only imagine at the beginning point, this must have been some type of a letdown. Wait a minute. As we'll see in these next few verses here. So, at the end here, material, bhuta indriya guna atmanam, that the senses, the modes of material nature, these are all working together for the living entities functioning here within this world. So, this reminded me, if I can divorce just a bit, this reminded me of the type of preaching I've been doing recently at Woodstock that we all do every day out in the field when we come in contact with people. The difference between energy, the difference between matter, spirit, the relationship of the senses with the mind, how one can perceive the presence of the soul, not only in this human body, but in all the different living entities throughout all of creation. First canto of the Bhagavatam, the presence of the Lord in his three different forms. The nature of material existence as it expands from the Supreme Personality of Godhead and then diverses itself, multifarious, as it diverses itself into multifarious different types of forms. So this isn't exactly the soothing topic that a separated lover delivers to the beloved. Just take my word on that. You don't just, it's not what the individual wants to hear. So then we go to verse 32. In verse 31 this continues. Translation, being composed of pure consciousness or knowledge, the soul is distinct from everything material and is uninvolved in the entanglements of the modes of nature. We can perceive the soul through the three functions of material nature known as wakefulness, sleep, and deep sleep. So here again, more deep philosophy, how to perceive the presence of the soul, how to perceive functioning reality of the material world. Purport. It is clearly stated here that the soul, Atma, is constituted of pure knowledge, pure consciousness, and is thus ontologically distinct from the material nature. I had a feeling for that word, but I actually had to look it up in the dictionary. I don't know how many of you know. This refers to spiritual understanding. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti points out that the word Atma may also be taken to mean the Supreme Soul, Lord Sri Krishna. Since the Lord has just explained in the previous verse that all material phenomena are expansions of himself, the phrase Maya vrittibhir iyate indicates that by studying this world deeply, we will come to the perception of God. From this point of view, the gopis are advised not to lament. So, study a little Sankha philosophy and you'll be okay, girls. You know, at the beginning of this conversation, and we all know the conversation takes another turn, we're not unknown to the storyline here. But at the beginning of this conversation, you know, one might just think, this guy just doesn't get it. You know, the classic example of a man speaking to his wife or his beloved or whatever, and just not connecting the dots. Krishna here, the explanation of if you stay absorbed in the difference between illusory consciousness and genuine consciousness, then you will be able to gain a better understanding of my reality, my presence, and you won't have to lament it being separated from me. Then we move on to verse 32. Translation. As a person just arisen from sleep may continue to meditate on a dream, even though it is illusory, so by the agency of the mind, one meditates on the sense objects, which the senses can then obtain. Therefore, one should become fully alert and bring the mind under control. This is like right out of the Bhagavad Gita, third chapter. You know, control your mind, control the senses, you know, don't let yourself wander. You know, everything is illusory. Purport here. The verb, pratipad, means to be perceived or restored. The soul that is Vinendra, free from dreamlike condition of material consciousness, is restored to its constitutional position as an eternal servitor of the Lord, Sri Krishna, and thus the soul is directly perceived by pure consciousness. Sometimes, mentions a dream state here, sometimes we have a good dream, sometimes we have a bad dream. Say you have a nice dream. I had a really nice dream the other night. I was with Madhava, Kirtan Madhava, and Kala Samvar and Vrindavan Kirtan, some devotees I just spent time having a wonderful experience in Woodstock with, and had spent time in Vrindavan with Las Kartik. These are just really great pals. And it was just such a great dream, and we were just having a good time doing Kirtan, and you know, just these kind of things. And so when you wake up, you have that memory, and it's very pleasant. And for the better part of the morning, I was remembering that and thinking of them, and then as a result, thinking of the times I've spent with them and things that we did and chuckling about that and then reminiscing about what we did there. And we had some nice prasadam on there, and then I'll remember that person we preached to there and how we got these people to dance in the Rath. Yeah, you know, different things like this. So, you know, from that dream state, it's an illusion. It may be an enjoyable illusion, but it's an illusion. And due to the attachment of that dream state, we stay in that illusory state. So for a better part of the day, I was living in that world. Very pleasant, nice association, but it wasn't the reality in front of me. Similarly, we also may have a bad dream. Something quite the opposite. You know, maybe as Prabhupada uses the classic example, maybe we're being chased by a tiger in a dream or being eaten by a tiger. Or I used to have this reoccurring dream when I was a little kid. Constantly, all the time. I was on a tricycle, and I was riding really fast, and I went over a cliff. And in the dream, I'm on the tricycle, and I'm just descending. Descending. I'm descending. And I am scared to hell. And in the dream, I'm terrified. But I always woke up before I hit the bottom. Now, according to some study on dreams or whatever, said, you have to wake up before you hit the bottom. If you hit the bottom and die, then you're dead, you know, and it actually connects to your physical. I don't know anything about that. But at any rate, I never hit the bottom. But I would wake up and that dream would be like in the forefront of my mind. Oh, and then the tricycle sitting in the corner, and I maybe didn't get on it that day, you know? So it was an illusion. It was a very painful illusion and a very vivid illusion, but it was one that holding on to it produced the other side of the result, you know, difficulty and anxiety and distress. So the result of meditating on one type of a dream is an enlivened, happy, peaceful state of mind. Illusory, but it motivates that kind of consciousness. The result of the other type of dream, one becomes distracted, one becomes a little bit bewildered. You know, when you have a really exhausting dream like that, sometimes you wake up and you're not fully rested. You're not able to focus on the activities in front of you to perform like that. So the word used in this verse, utita. Now those of us that engage in deity worship know it in its other phrase, utishta. Wake up, wake up. This is a common phrase used, to wake up. And this is what we're encouraging you to do, wake up from that dreaming state. It may be a good dream, it may be a bad dream. It is a dreaming state. Wake up from that and perceive the reality of consciousness. So, a very short purport here, but it highlights two very valuable Sanskrit words. Pratipad and Vinindra, I'm pronouncing it wrong, I'm sure. Pratipad means to perceive or to restore, to be perceived or to restore. So this means to see things as they are and put them back into their proper perspective. Not just to know the difference, but to bring it into its proper perspective once you know that difference. This is what we're encouraged to do in spiritual life. And Vinidra, to become free from that dreamlike state of consciousness. So these two words indicate what this verse is trying to encourage the living entity to do. To free ourselves from the illusion, restore ourselves to the proper condition of consciousness, free from the influence of the dreamlike state. And then you have a concluding statement at the end used by the word therefore. Therefore, one should become fully alert and bring the mind under control. Whether it's a good dream or a bad dream, if you're living in that dream consciousness, you're not focused on the here and now. You know? I got an individual I work with at work, and the guy's always in another place. He's trying to do something, but his brain is always somewhere else. Hey, over here, come on, focus. You know, sometimes you have a little child like that, you know. Children, come on, focus. No, right here. Because the mind's always wandering. So if we do not have control over the senses, if we do not have control over the mind, and in the earlier parts of the Bhagavatam, this is the instructions through the teachings of Ambarish Maharaj, Savaimana Krishna Padara Vindayo. First control the mind, then from the mind the senses will come under control. And then once everything's controlled, we can engage ourselves properly. So this is the contrast here that's being presented in this particular verse. Now we move on to verse 33, and interesting the way it starts out here. According to intelligent authorities, is there another kind of authority? Of course there is, our mind, our senses, when they're not controlled, but, you know, those aren't the authorities we want. So according to intelligent, I'm looking for that word here. Doesn't break it down that way. So, according to intelligent authorities, this is the ultimate conclusion of all the Vedas, as well as all practice of yoga, Sankhya, renunciation, austerity, sense control, and truthfulness, just as the sea is the ultimate destination of all rivers. This is one of the beauties of Vedic literature, analogies. Prabhupada was the king of analogies. I think there's even a book, Prabhupada's Analogies, just going through and listed all of them, you know. Just as the goal of every river is to go to the ocean, to work its way, you know. I grew up in St. Louis on the Mississippi River. Mississippi River starts up in the middle of nowhere and works its way down with one goal, to get to the Gulf of Mexico and then to meet up with the ocean. Well, this is the real purpose. So in the same way, it's saying is that, and that focus, you can't change it. That you're not going to stop the river. You're not putting a dam up to stop the Mississippi River. They dam smaller rivers. Hey, don't dam the Mississippi River. So here you see that despite all of these different processes, they have the ultimate goal. Now, the purport here. Here the Lord states that all Vedic literature is meant ultimately to bring the soul to the point of controlling the mind, controlling the senses, and fixing them in transcendental consciousness. Transcendental self-realization. Thus, processes of so-called yoga, I love it when that word is used, so-called yoga, mysticism, or religion that involve unrestricted sense gratification are not actually spiritual processes. They're not. But rather convenient ways for foolish people to justify their beastly behavior. That's a double slap in the face. You know, you slap somebody in the face to wake them up, but then you slap them a second time. So, right here, this is just a double slap. A convenient way for foolish people, you're foolish, to justify their beastly behavior. Not only are you foolish, but you're an animal. I mean, this is the nature of Bhagavatam, and those that are translating and presenting Bhagavatam, be very forthcoming and very bold. So this is a conclusive turn right here. It's the culminating point where this entire chapter begins to take a turn. The subject that the subject that we've got being spoken to the gopis, and that's being presented by the Vaishnavas is the importance of real spirituality. Now, the word used here is anta. Anta means ultimate conclusion. The actual translation here, at its conclusion. So it starts off, it says, thus, this is the ultimate conclusion. So what is it referring to, this? This refers back to the previous verse where the conclusion is given. Therefore, one should become fully alert and bring the mind under control. So he's saying this is the conclusion of yoga, sankhya, renunciation, austerity, sense control, and truthfulness. If you're interested in any of those paths, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 major paths of self-realization. If you're interested in any of those six paths, the ultimate conclusion is to bring your mind and senses under control. So this is very instructive, particularly as we apply it to our modern age. The middle two lines there list all of these different ideas, and this is what we see going on around us. Now, the concluding words of therefore mean that this has to be taken seriously. This isn't an optional choice. Optional choice means, if you want to. This is being said definitively that if you're interested in these things, if you're interested in success in these paths, this is what you must do. The modern day yoga is pinpointed here in this particular purport. Mysticism and religious processes too. It reminded me here again of my recent experience in Woodstock. We set up the Krishna's Village of Peace there, and one of the things that we have there is a yoga tent. So people can practice some yoga and all like that. And it's very common. You see the practitioners that want to take part, they come over to the yoga tent, they set their can of beer down at the entrance because there's no alcohol allowed in the yoga tent. And they go into the yoga tent, they perform their yoga activities for a half hour, 45 minutes, whatever it is. And they get finished and they go back outside and pick the can of beer up and continue on with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever the case may be. And then they maybe drift over to the food court, which, and our food court is wonderful, Krishna Prasadam, fabulous rice with wonderful sabji and nice halava and papadums. Or they may go over to the other food court where there's some unmentionable dead animals being served up. So, and then they, I did some yoga today. Was this before or after you engaged in all three of the major activities which will deter any possible progress? Intoxication, meat eating, and illicit sex. Sometimes in the question and answer booth, I get a question. A lot of times they get questions about Kundalini yoga. Attaining Kundalini yoga and the soul leaving the body. So I tell them, I say, well, there's three things that are required for success in Kundalini yoga. Celibacy from birth, have never eaten any type of animal product, and constant state of peace of mind. So everybody in the tent that's got that, please raise your hand. No hands go up. So therefore, don't focus too much on this, trying to perfect this Kundalini yoga process you're describing. So this is the activity of the modern man. It's not just at this particular festival, it's a rock festival, whatever, he's a degenerate. No, you go anywhere. Go to the lunchroom at Lowe's, where sometimes I'm forced by circumstance of too much rain to sit instead of be able to go outside and sit on the hill under a tree and take my next prasadam. Forced to sit in this room, and the stuff that these people take out of their boxes to put in their mouths is just unbelievable. How do they do this? But at the same time, they profess to be able to practice religious principles. Now, of course, nobody there is developing mysticism or performing yoga. They can barely bend over and touch their toes, what to speak of anything else. So, this is the condition of modern men. As it says in the purport, foolish people who are simply justifying their beastly behavior. So, in this particular way, we see that Lord Krishna is then saying, the purport here finishes. Lord Krishna here assures the gopis that by fixing their minds in self-realization, they will realize their spiritual oneness with the Lord and thus no longer suffer the pains of separation. Yeah, right. That's not what the gopis are looking for. Okay, let us just sit down and think of our connection to the supreme energy by controlling our mind and senses. And then, oh, it doesn't matter, the Krishna's not here having rasa dance or stealing butter from our homes or taking our clothes or killing the Agasura demon or all these things. We don't have to worry about it. This is not satisfying to the gopis. Just think of me in self-realization and you'll be one with me and thus be satisfied. So this is the first few verses of this section here. But now at verse 34, Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, brings it all together and pivots things around. Now he begins to sort of go on an explanation as to why he has presented this. Translation. But, anytime you add that in, there's something else I want to, okay, all that, but there's something else I want to add in. But the actual reason why I, the beloved object of your sight, has stayed away from you is that I wanted to intensify your meditation upon me and thus draw your minds closer to me. Isn't it the goal of our Krishna consciousness? To try and think of the form of the Lord. This is why we come to the temple in the morning. This is why we have the beautiful deities of Radha Shyam Sundar, Krishna Balaram Purnitai. This is why we engage in such elaborate Sringar. So that when we see the form of the Lord, that form will fix itself in our mind, and then throughout the day we can recall that form. This is the ultimate goal of devotional service, to think of the Lord all the time. Purport. Sometimes that which is close to your eyes is far away from your heart and mind. And conversely, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Although apparently going far away from the gopis, Lord Krishna was bringing them closer to him on the spiritual platform. Now, we've all experienced this every day. I'm going to give a completely mundane example, but it is a perfect analogy of the point being made here. Sometimes I'm having to work at Lowe's. Yes, some people actually wonder, do I ever work there? So sometimes when I'm working there, I'm thinking, oh, like for instance, a couple of years ago, I didn't get to go to Kartik. Didn't get to go to Govardhan. So I'm thinking, well, I really wish I was at Govardhan. Kusum Sarovara, and then from Kusum Sarovara, you go down the road just a little ways, and you get to Sham Kutira. Oh, and inside Sham Kutira is a wonderful kunz there, Ratna Kund, a very beautiful place. And that's where Govardhan just begins to come out of the ground a little bit, and then you go down a little further, you're at Manasigang. So in this way, you know. So as it says, that which is close to our eyes, Lowe's, my working environment, is far from the heart and the mind. And that which conversely is far from the eyes is close to the heart and the mind. This is our goal in devotional service. And we will do anything to trick ourselves into that. If you come to my desk at Lowe's, I have a little piece of a stone from a brick out in the garden department that broke off, and it just looks a little bit like Govardhan Hill. So I set it on my desk, and I have a little bitty green parrot that I got in Vrindavan that I set next to it. So at least 600 times a day when I look at that desk, I can think, oh, okay, Govardhan. So we have to figure some way to trick our mind into remembering the Lord. Because why? Because according to these first five verses I've just been reading, our senses are not in control, our mind is not under control, and our mind is not fixed always on remembering the personality of Godhead. We have to do these little things. So whatever it takes to remember the Lord, this is the way we should be looking at things. So then we go to verse 35. Translation. When her lover is far away, a woman thinks of him more than when he is present before her. Purport. According to Srila Vishnu, well, before the purport, this verse right here, this is the classic example that is given, the paramour. And Prabhupada describes this many times, the acharyas describe it many times, and they always give the example of the woman. That when the woman is engaged in her household duties but thinking of her lover, or when the woman is separated from her beloved, she's always thinking of him in that way. And so we have always in our maleness spoken of this, and yes, looking at it from two perspectives. One, that okay, it's the woman who's thinking like that, right? It's the example of the ladies, you know. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, tosses a twist in here. If you read the purport, according to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the same holds true for men. Boom. Who become more absorbed in thinking of a beloved woman when she is far away than when she is present before their eyes. So you can look at this from two perspectives. If your mentality had been, well, that's the women that are attached like that. Well, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, so are the men. Or if you were thinking, you know, wow, the ladies are so advanced, you get to think of their lord like that. Well, Vishwanath Chakravarti says, so can you if you're a man. Completely destroys the whole bodily concept of life of a man thinks like that or a woman thinks like that. In other words, anyone separated from their beloved thinks more of them than when they're actually with the beloved. This refers back to the point Krishna is making in the previous verse. This is why I have gone to Dwarka. This is why I have not come back to you. So that your memory of me, so that your remembrance of me, so that your thinking of me will be enhanced by that separation. This is the amazing thing of our particular line, is this mood of separation is so prominent, so important. Sometimes when I'm traveling with an Aduna Maharaj, we'll be served a meal and all. My wife makes this too. But she actually makes it a little better. She does this or that. And Aduna Maharaj teases me, says, your wife, maybe I should just send you back home. So, you know, in this way, I'm not there with her, but I'm thinking of her, you know. So a man can also think in that way. So similarly, we should also be thinking in that way. I didn't get to go to the temple this morning. I had to go to work to an early shift. But fortunately, we have the internet connection. It's the most painful thing when it rains in the morning. And, you know, around here, if it rains, it means your electrical's going out. Boom. And the computer goes down. Or, are you paying attention, Krishna.com? When the connection doesn't work, it's really agonizing if you're depending on that camera right there giving you the darshan of Radha Shyam Sundar before you go off on your daily activities and it's not there. You immediately feel some separation. What do they look like today? And what outfit are they wearing today? You know? Fortunately, I leave for work just after the darshan at 7:20. So I get to see the deities. I get a nice darshan of whatever outfit or what turban or what crown or what garland or who dressed and like that, you know? So this allows us to enhance that remembrance, even though we're separated. This is what we have to strive for in Krishna consciousness. This is what Srila Prabhupada encouraged us to do. Then we go to text 36. Translation. Because your minds are totally absorbed in me and free from all other engagement, you remember me always, and so you will very soon have me again in your presence. This is the encouragement every devotee wants to hear. Because your mind is absorbed in me, because you're giving up other engagements, because you're remembering me, you will soon have me in your presence. This is the instruction Krishna's giving to the gopis. Prabhupada encouraged us like that. He prodded us that way. Just chant your 16 rounds, follow the four regulative principles, you go back to Godhead. Boom. Is that easy? Just do it. Prabhupada would encourage us. Krishna's encouraging the gopis. Just keep thinking of me, and I will be in your heart. I will be in your presence, you know. So in this way, the encouragement is being given that, all right, all of this philosophy and this attachment and controlling the senses and fixing your mind is to bring you to this point, where once all that is done, now you can think of me. And we conclude with verse 37. Although some gopis had to remain in the cowherd village and could not join the rasa dance to sport with me at night in the forest, they were nonetheless fortunate. Indeed, they obtained me by thinking of my potent pastimes. This is a wonderful blessing. Those of us that cannot actually be physically at a place where the pastimes of the Lord is going on have some solace here. Just like, as I was giving the example earlier, if you desire to go to Kartik, there are many devotees that want to go to Kartik. Go to Vrindavan for Kartik. Not everyone can do it. But by meditating in that way on the activities going on in Vrindavan, on the pastimes going on in Vrindavan, on the activities performed during Kartik, one can be given the same result as if you were there. This is the potency. Well, I don't want to say potency, I'm going to say the word twice. This is the benefit of the potent pastimes of the Lord. Just by remembering them, you can get that result. Or a more practical example, many times the festival days fall on a work day. For instance, Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja this week falls on a Monday. There are a lot of devotees that have jobs Monday to Friday. They're just not going to be able to make it. Now, amazingly nonetheless, when it comes time for prasadam, you'll see 2,500 devotees out there on Monday. They get their lunch break or whatever, and I'll be one of them because I have to work that day. I couldn't get off because I got off for Janmashtami. So, but if you're thinking of what's going on, if you're meditating on what's going on, if you've got a little earphone plugged in your ear connected to radio and you've got the connection on and you're listening to what's going on, you can be given the same result, the same benefit. So this is the result we get as an impact, as a benediction of the potent pastimes of the Lord and his devotees. So all in all, we should know that the process of remembering the Lord is very, very, very essential and desirable. In 1976, I don't remember if it was a morning walk or a darshan, Srila Prabhupada was explaining the verse, man mana bhava man bhakto. He said, you have to think of something. You're always thinking. So you're thinking of something, so why not think of Krishna? It's not like you're not thinking. Everybody's thinking at every moment. Why not think of Krishna? He says, if you're 85% Krishna conscious, that means you're 15% in Maya. And if you're 15% Krishna conscious, that means you're 85% in Maya. But then he says, but if you are 100% Krishna conscious, there is no Maya. So this is our goal. This is our goal, to be 100% fixed in controlling our mind and our senses so that we can remember the pastimes of the Lord. So I want to finish today's class with two short little stories from Woodstock that were really amazing. I know I'm running a little over time. I've been going to Woodstock for 10 years now and speaking in the question and answer booth there every day. And so there's a few people that I've come to know from year to year to year. And, you know, they see you on the Rath Yatra before we start opening the village and, oh, yeah, you know, big hugs and then conversation. So there's these two boys that have been coming for, I don't know, I guess the last 5 or 6 years. And real nice boys, and they come and sit in the question and answer booth quite often and ask very intelligent questions. We have conversations afterwards on, you know, when we're in the Harinams or whatever, when they see me out on the festival site and all. So the one boy is a very devout Catholic. And, of course, how that fits into, he's always got a can of beer in his hand, I don't know. But at any rate, he's, you know, he's a very serious Catholic. So I told him one year, he said to me this year, he said, I remember something you told me a couple of years ago. I said, yeah. He said, you told me I don't have to change to become a Hare Krishna, but if I just be the best Catholic I can be, that will help me in my advancement of becoming God conscious. I said, yeah. He said, so I work as a machinist, and I, you know, cut out of metal, and I manufacture locks and things. I said, okay. He said, so I had a break one day, and I thought, what should I do during this break? He said, I thought to myself, I should chant the rosary. So I took a bolt, and I put a number of washers on it, and then I put another nut at the end and sealed that off, and I would chant the rosary and move a washer each time I chanted a rosary. He said, so I made one for you to chant your Hare Krishna mantra on. And he gave it to me. And here it is. It's a bolt with a nut sealed at the end and washers. He said, you just move one washer. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. Move the next washer. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. He said, so I'm giving you this as a gift. I thought, wow, it's pretty far out. So then there was another conversation in the question and answer booth, and it was, of course, on vegetarianism. This happens a lot. And, you know, the whole, you know, we all know the drill, you know, killing the animals and, you know, this and that, and you're slaughtering animals by the millions, and, you know, you should be, you know, all the arguments. We all had it. So the conversation goes on. So there's this one lady in the middle of the tent. We're having conversations back and forth, and there's several people talking, but she's part of the conversation. I can tell from the conversation she's a vegetarian. She looks to be like in her late 30s or early 40s or something, a very pleasant-looking person. And I can tell she's following a vegetarian diet and all like that. And so, you know, the conversation's going. So I'm taking questions from here, and then there's a kid sitting next to her, and he raises his hand. I said, yeah. He says, I don't kill the animals, so I'm not getting any of the karma. I just eat them. I said, well, I said, that's a nice sentiment. But the fact is, there are 7 people connected to the animal slaughter process, they get the karma for that. And I list all seven, one of which, of course, is the person that cooks it, the person that serves, someone like that. So I tell him that, so he raises his hand right after. I said, yeah, and he points to the lady next to him that I had no idea was his mother. He says, well, this is my mother, and she's a vegetarian, but she cooks meat for me. So you're telling me she's getting the karma for killing an animal, even though she's a vegetarian? So I look at this woman, and I can see this kind of distressed look in her face. So I said, do you want a pleasant answer, or you want me to tell you the truth? He says, well, the truth. I said, yes, she's getting the karma for cooking animals. And, you know, I felt a little awkward. I just put this woman on the spot, and, you know, so at any rate, the questions go on, and I'm thinking in my mind, okay, I hope when my session's done, they're still here. I want to talk to them a little bit. So anyway, they get up and leave before the session's done. It's, you know, all right, what can you do? So the next session, I'm in there speaking, and I see she walks across the outside of the tent going from place A to B. We make eye contact. I wave at her. She waves back at me and smiles. I said, okay, there seems to be no hard feelings. So the session after that, she comes in, and she sits in the tent again, and there's questions and answers going on. So when I finish, she's still there. So I motion to her to wait. I grab my translator, and I go out, and much to my surprise, I find she speaks perfect English. So this is great. So I said to her, I said, I wanted to apologize for embarrassing you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that. You know, she said, no, actually, I was hoping to speak with you. I wanted to thank you. She says, I'm a vegetarian. My husband's a vegetarian. My other two children are, but this is my oldest child, my son, and he's not. And he insisted, you're my mother. You have to cook for me, and this is what I want. And I've been doing this for a year now, and I just hate doing it. The disgusting smell and the odor lingers in the house. And I decided a couple weeks ago, I'm not doing it anymore. But I didn't know how to come to that point. And then when you answered his question, I saw a tear go down my son's cheek. And I saw a change take place in him. And after we were finished, he came to me and said, Mom, you don't have to cook meat for me anymore. So she said, I wanted to thank you. So, you know, you have these kind of experiences in the least likely places when you go out there in the preaching field. And so, you know, this is why everybody should take an opportunity to go to Woodstock once in their life and get this wonderful preaching experience. Joy. Had a question, Lakshmi? Okay. So I've run way over time. John Mosmi, for a while. No mic. You have a... Oh, there we go.
Hare Krishna. So, it seems a little bit like Krishna's message is an instruction for us. That's, so, you know, the tattva part.
More than a little bit. Yeah.
And, you know, so that's sandwiched in there to encourage us to keep going, you know, with our sadhana and, you know, because there's an end in sight. It doesn't seem so, like you made the point. What's that got to do with a missing lover, you know? And,
Well, but as I think I made this point a little bit before you came into the class, but, you know, the point is that this is instructive to us on many levels, on the philosophical level, as it applies to executing devotional service, and then on a practical level as it applies to advancement in devotional service and what our meditation is for that and during that. That's the interesting thing, you know. Krishna consciousness is the means and the ends. You become Krishna conscious by executing devotional service, and then when you become Krishna conscious, you execute devotional service. So, you know, it's the path that gets you there, and then when you get there, you continue to do the same thing. So it is very instructive in that sense. It's not just a conversation between Krishna and the gopi. I mean, Uddhava and the gopis. Well, ultimately Krishna. It's not just that. It's instructive to us about how we can come to that level.
How is that first part relevant to the gopis?
Huh?
How is that first part relevant to the gopis?
Well, because Krishna is building up to the philosophical conclusion of that Sankhya process, if you will, of that control of senses and mind, that, boom, by doing that, you can stay focused. Who has more control over the senses and mind than the gopis? Not by the intentional effort of executing tapas, tyagi, sense control, yoga, shankha meditation, but because of their devotional practices, because of the meditation on Krishna, they have accomplished all that. So that's all being laid out. That way there's... I look at it from the perspective that way there's no misconception about just becoming a sahaja and jumping right up there. As it mentions in that one purport, you know, the so-called execution of yoga, mysticism and religiousness while not controlling the mind and senses is just nonsense.
So it's, in one sense, it's a very positive reciprocation with the gopis.
Yeah.
That they've made it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else? We'll finish there. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak on Srimad Bhagavatam. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.